was the Morehouse Choir with We Shall Overcome. Not our normal opening song, but a beautiful one nonetheless. Welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marulia Duffels, and we hope together our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to all of us and affect all our lives. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. Tonight we have a great guest, but first let me introduce my co-host, my brilliant co-host, Marulia Duffels. Marulia, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you? And how are you, Rock? Nice to meet you this
week. I'm fantastic.
Well, we're so happy to have you with us tonight, Rock Newman. Rock Newman is our guest tonight, and he's an amazing guy who was a legendary boxing promoter, and he is the producer of the one and only Dick Gregory, a movie that I saw, which was great, Elite Youth, and The Legendary Knights. He's a graduate of Harvard University and executive producer of the way cool Rock Newman Show. And we're glad to have him with us tonight to talk about everything DC and what he's doing. And let's start by talking about WEAC Radio, Rock, because this is going to be our first show on WEAC Radio. We've just been picked up by WEAC. And it's one of the reasons that we so wanted to have you on the first show, because as I told you off the air, I went to their 10th anniversary party on Thursday, and everybody was talking about Rock Newman. What a great guy you are. So thanks so much for being with us. And
let me say, you know, thank you guys, you and your team, for inviting me. As I told you, I really looked forward to doing this. One, because of you and your co-host, or I should say not necessarily in any order, but you and your co-host who I have much respect for, and the fact that you're doing you're having your maiden voyage here on WEAC Radio, where I reintroduced myself, if you will, to Washington, D.C. on February the 23rd, 2013 with the Rock Newman talk show. Mm-hmm. It was a Saturday morning. We did 3 hours. And, you know, I can tell you, you right now are starting at a wonderful place. It's the station that I referred to as the little train that could. It's a little train. It's got a big engine, and it makes big impact. And thank God, man, that you guys were able to get married, because you know what you bring to the table with your activism and involvement, and what Marillis does. It absolutely, in my estimation, it very much fits with WEAC Radio, and I see that as a great marriage. And, you know, just I'm rooting for you to keep making the impact that I know you'll make.
Well, thanks. And I got to tell you, unfortunately, Marulia was like you. Marulia was stuck in Wyoming. Correct me if I'm wrong, Marulia. But like I haven't heard that excuse before, you know. I can't go out with you. I'm stuck in Wyoming. But anyway, it was such a warm place, Rock. I can't tell you. I felt like I just felt at home there. First of all, there were 20 people that showed up at the party that I knew. And I just, you know, yeah. I'm like, this is where we should have been all along. Hey, can we talk about Dick Gregory? Because we love him on this show.
I'm so sorry I missed the party. I was so looking forward to meeting you, Rock. You are a person to be admired, and I'm just in awe of what you've accomplished and what you've done over the years. And I know we'll get to talking about it, I'm sure, but the steps that you took to sort of not divorce yourself, but for lack of a better word, from the boxing, world, and I'm just in great admiration.
It was a divorce. It's okay to use that word. It was a divorce.
Okay.
And let's start there. Rock, my dad, growing up, my dad had a buddy who was a boxing promoter in Washington, D.C. His name was Nat Kane. I don't know if you remember Nat Kane. He owned a bar called
Absolutely, I do. Yeah.
He owned a bar called Little Bit of Ireland. So I knew a bunch of boxers growing up, and not something I ever wanted to do, because I saw it was a hard life for these people. Let's start there, since we really have brought it up. What is it about, why did you leave the boxing profession?
I had always said, it's a two-part answer, I think. I had always said that when the guy that I was representing, Riddick Bowe, who became the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world, that when he retired, that I would retire. I never saw myself as a boxing guy, if you will. I was never a part of the boxing fraternity. They had a lot of disdain for me and some of the independent stands that I took. And frankly, I wore their disdain as a badge of honor. I never wanted to emulate anybody, that was in that business. So I saw myself more as a business person who had fallen in love with, the fighter. And I've been accused of, you fall in love with your fighters. And, so I knew that for the most part, Riddick Bowe would be the last thing that I would do. And so when he retired, it just was a natural progression for me to step off. Now, I flirted with a couple of things afterwards. One of them I'm really proud of, and that was we brought the Mike Tyson fight to Washington, D.C., in 2005, and had almost a sold out arena there, and did a lot better than a lot of people thought that Tyson fight would do when he sort of lost his last fight. So then through the years, I've looked back and I felt like I'm not necessarily proud of the fact that I'm sitting there and screaming my head off and, rooting for my fighter to tear the other guy's head off. There's just something that I guess maybe as I matured, as I had gotten older, that really didn't sit that well with me. And then one evening, I'm just kind of flipping around the dial, and I see these two Hispanic fighters are fighting, and both of them are big punchers, and neither one of them had much defense at all. That's a prescription for disaster. They were fighting maybe a 6-round fight, probably at the most was getting $750, $1,000 each. And at the end of the fight, their faces were a bloody mess. And just like, like a grinder had gone through both of them. Mm. And I made a decision at that point. I'm stepping off. I'm not paying for any more fights. I'm not going to contribute to any pay-per-view. I'm not going to sit in judgment of others who continue to enjoy it, love it as they will. It's just no longer for me. And I have not been to a fight now in years, and I've not, paid for any kind of fight. And the more I age, I just wish it wasn't a way that some people felt was the only way for them to make money. Because there's so much negative that comes out of it in terms of brain injuries and the rest that I just don't like it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, just listen. I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, Marilia,
That's
but
okay.
just All you have to do is listen to Muhammad Ali talk, you know.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
At the end of his life, as brilliant a man as he was. So go ahead, Marilee. I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No worries. I was just going to say, Rock, I think you said it beautifully. I read your words. I don't know that you said it verbally. I'm sure you did at some point. But you said there's a certain barbaric savagery that I can't allow myself to be a supporter of ever again. And I think that's just so beautifully put. And you also mentioned that, you know, the whole boxing thing is about hitting someone so hard on the chin that it short circuits the brain. So I think that that's fabulous that you saw that. That's fabulous that you called it out. But you also said, which I found very interesting, and I think in growing up, I used to see that in high school and in junior high, I believe. But you said it was a great discipline for young kids, which, as I said, I saw. And it used to be, which is the point I'm making. So what changed? Why isn't it that anymore? And not that I'm for short-circuiting the brain or the barbaric savagery, as you so well put it. But what changed? And why was it such good discipline? And
well, you know, I will say,
mm-hmm.
what changed was really me.
Yeah.
And my observation and assessment of it, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. I, you know, the senator is obviously, you know, very active, and he mm-hmm. tries to right wrongs of society. And one of the things that he fights for and tries to right is, you know, racism that exists. So I look at racism and it's like, okay, you know, man, what can we do to better society, to eliminate racism? I look at two people in the ring, unmistakably. The idea is to hit each other, as, you know, you said I was quoted, as is to hit each other that it short circuits the brain. There's a certain barbarism to that. That I would like our society to evolve out of, that we, that's appealing to our, I think, lower humanity. And across the board, you know, and Lord knows, I'm not trying to be anybody's Mother Teresa here, but across the board, if you just take boxing, MMA, and all for its worth, you know, the idea is I'm going to come in and I'm going to knock you out. I am going to hurt you. And I just wish that we would find a way to eliminate that from our society, frankly speaking.
Yeah,
and
I don't
said it beautifully, too. Evolve out of. I would like society to evolve out of that. That is beautiful. And I think it's sad to say, and it's a sad commentary on what I imagine is just the monetary underpinning of this whole sport and many other things in life, of course, is always money. And so how do we get around that? How do we evolve? It's the 21st century. You know, we're not Cro-Magnon men or Neanderthal men anymore. Why are we still here?
Well, you know what, Marilee, and Rock, I think you're seeing that with my kids, for example. Like when this may sound strange to you, Marilee, coming from Brazil, but when I was a kid, soccer didn't exist as far as we knew it. You know, it just wasn't a sport. It just wasn't a sport in America, and now it's It's overtaken with children. I mean, my kids started playing soccer when they were 3 years old. And I think that's one of the things that attracts parents to that sport is that it's not like football. It's not even like basketball. People aren't hitting each other. You know, they're attacking a ball instead of attacking each other. So maybe the popularity of sports like soccer means that we, in this country anyway, means that we are kind of maturing out of it. I hope that's the case. Let's talk about Dick Gregory for a minute, if you don't mind. Dick Gregory is a guy that came to my all-white little suburban college when I was in college and made us laugh so hard that we couldn't breathe. And then when he left, we all started thinking about the things he said. And wasn't that his amazing talent, that Rock, that he was able to use his comedy to make us think? Rock.
You know, Greg had a certain and specific genius.
Yeah,
that
did.
Indeed could do that. I never saw him in a situation, and we've been in, you know, I've known Greg for many, many years, 50 years, and have been with him in many different situations. And I've never been in a situation where he wasn't able to read the crowd perfectly and introduce a cross between a deep subject matter and a side-splitting humor, where indeed, as you just said, oftentimes it might be you might not have got it when he first said it or when he dropped the morsels of knowledge that he would drop, laced with his incredible sense of humor. But a couple of days later, you would think, and long before Arsenio Hall came up with that phrase that says things that make you go, Dick Gregory was doing that 40 years earlier. And he came along in a time of such overt racism and oppression that it took his keen wit to be able to go into places where, you know, heretofore blacks had not been able to go, and to be able to communicate to an all-white redneck audience, to be able to communicate to them in a way where they enjoyed themselves. Now, he would be calling out some of their frailties of their society, some of the very issues, but they were, you know, side-splitting in their laughter. And so that took a unique talent, and that is why, I mean, it would not be unfair at all to call Dick Gregory truly one of America's originals. I mean, he stepped forward and paved the way for others with a sense of commitment, with a sense of courage, with a sense of dignity that says, no, Jack Parr, I'm not coming on the Tonight Show and not be able to sit on the couch like your other guests do. I don't care what that means. I know that being on your show is going to take me from being a $1,500 night comic to a $50,000 night comic, but I will not do it if I'm not treated with the same dignity that you treat others. I'm not going to be a second. I'm not going to allow you to treat me like a second-class citizen. Treat me as a first-class citizen, and I'll come on. And they eventually relented, and that opened the door for so many to come afterwards. So, man, oh, my God, I just can't say enough about his greatness, about his compassion, about his courage, about his vision, and most of all, his incredibly deep reservoir of humanity for all people, for all people.
He was an amazing guy, and I didn't know him very well, but he was very kind to me. And we did an event for him on his birthday. The first birthday after his passing, they did a show at the Arena Stage, and we bought 100 orchestra tickets, and we threw a birthday party with along with Christopher and Ayana and his children. Christopher has been on the show. Ife Williams, Keith Silver, you, all these people that knew him. He was a wonderful and generous guy. But I want to hit on one thing that you said about his ability to read the audience. Mm. We've just had this problem with Dave Chappelle, where Dave Chappelle made some comments about gay and transgender people. And now they're talking at Duke Ellington, which is the school he attended, and they were going to name the auditorium after him, about withdrawing that because of the things he said. Is that because we have the internet now and you can't read your audience? You know what I mean? Your audience ends up being everybody, right? Whether you choose it to be or not. And then we get to dissect everything you say and put it under a microscope. Is that what do you think about this thing with Dave Chappelle? Isn't comedy like Dick Gregory's and Lenny Bruce and, you know, people like that? Isn't it supposed to be cutting edge? Isn't it supposed to offend us to a certain extent?
This is indeed a different day with all of the ways that people have access to what people do and what people say. I would just so strongly advise against behavior, commentary, activity that attempts to censor authenticity. You know, and Chappelle, at his core, is very authentic. He, like every one of us that are blessed to wake up in the morning, is far from perfect. But man, he's an incredible, incredible talent who really is extraordinarily authentic. Now, comedians, by and large, they point out things amongst us and about us that we may not like. But that is their, to me, that is their job. That is their job, and that is a special talent that they have. And, you know, I am really not well-versed in exactly what this most recent flare-up is about.
Yeah, me
but
either.
I think that he has been authentic. He said, hey, I said what I said. I stand by. He made some observations that offended some people. Now, Lord knows, I would support their right to register their complaint, their disgust, or whatever. But again, man, I very much would like to see us be able to get to a place where we can have disagreement without being so disagreeable. You know,
yes.
I think for quite some time, and I've got to go here, Senator, it's a field that you're in, is that, you know, for quite some time, when at the advent of the Tea Party, if you will, that there is a sense of, if you don't agree with my position, you're the enemy.
Yeah.
And Lord knows, Donald Trump coming into office, I mean, he put a seal of approval on that kind of thinking that I truly believe ushered in just some terrible sentiments and made it that a lack of civility, a lack of human decency, a lack of caring for one another became their brand. And so many people are glomming onto that, are attaching themselves to that. So anytime that there is a dispute, anytime that there is a debate, anytime that someone says something that someone else doesn't like, there has to be a fight that wants to hit you on your chin and short-circuit your life, short-circuit your career. I take it back to boxing, you know, and I don't know. Again, from my place here, man, I just appeal for us to be a more a more humane society. And
to your point,
and I applaud, once again, I applaud the kind of show that I know you guys are doing, and I applaud We Act Radio for giving the kind of platform to make a difference in the community. Yeah. I remember the first day I met Timon Freeman. He said, "You want to make money, or you want to make a difference?" And I said, "Both." He said, "Then let's talk. Let's talk."
Well, that's the nice thing about politics is you can do that. And yeah. You know, the point of this show to begin with was I had a Republican co-host. Now I have a co-host who was a woman who was. A Republican for many years and is now an independent, because we want to show that you can have a different opinion and a different view of things, but you can still, you can still be civil with each other and agree. And so let me let my amazing co-host ask something. I've known Marilia for, I don't want to tell you how many years, because that'll give away how ancient I am. But she's an amazing person, and she has I'm sure she has a different perspective than mine on a lot of things. But, you know, I have a deep, deep respect for her. And I think that's what it's all about. It's all about just respecting the other person, absolutely, whether they agree with you or not. But go ahead. Now that I respect you, let me actually let you say something. Go ahead,
and I respect you, and I admire you, Mike. And I know, thanks. I think you know that. So it goes both ways. Thank you so much. I just want to say, to your point, Rock, very always well articulated and well made, about getting back to Chappelle and the ability to joke about other people's whatever it is, assets or shortcomings. And let me tell you that I would hope that this would be the case in our culture. And having grown up in Brazil, I am here to tell you that that is what Brazilian culture was. I can't speak for it now because things are changing, and indeed, it's very much, the Bolsonaro administration is very much influenced by the Trump ideology, the Trump people. In fact, he's called the Tropical Trump. But the Brazilian culture, Brazilian society is one that actually thrives on joking about each other. And you express your love, your affection, your admiration for your family, for members of your family, or for your friends, or even perfect strangers in sort of joking. It's this jocular sort of assessment of each other's assets or shortcomings. And if you don't do it, you don't care about the person. And it is entrenched in the culture where you just kind of tease each other, make jokes about each other, and it's a two-way banter, and it brings so much laughter and joy. Laughter brings joy. Laughter is good medicine for the soul. And that's the way Brazilian culture is. And nobody takes offense. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the way. I mean, me too. I mean, Marilia, I was raised in a family like that. You know,
yes.
My father used to say things to me like, "You got a face only your mother could love." You know, and right, and right, and they would say things to, they would say things like that to you. Or I remember my brother was a great athlete, and I was the worst kid on my little league team. And I would say to him, he would say things to me like, "If mom ever sells the station wagon," because we had a big station wagon, they said, she would say, "They'll cut you from the team. The only reason you're on the team is because she can take 9 kids to the game." You know, so, and we didn't worry about that. It wasn't,
right.
You know, it
no
was
offense.
Right. Have we become so sensitive, Rock, that we can't say anything about anybody, you know? I mean, and why is that? You know, look at Archie Bunker. Could you have had All in the Family? Could you have had that show today, you think?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. That particular show, you know, I think it was groundbreaking in its approach to trying to address some of the issues that are in society today. I think that there is an overall overarching hypersensitivity that we're prone more to take things personally and to be more easily offended than time passed. And, you know, whether or not that is the, you know, how small the world has become through technology, I don't know. I don't know the answer. I mean, I swear it, man. You're going to have to get somebody on that's probably above my pay grade to deal with that psychology. I just know that, you know, to have to walk around and walk on eggshells when you're trying to communicate, as Marosa was saying, you know, as they did in her home, in a jocular manner, that, you know, offense is so easily and quickly taken. I don't know why. I don't know why it is. I don't know why that is the case today. But I definitely, I certainly see and hear and feel what you all are communicating about that.
Well, let me ask. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Maria.
No, it just seems to me that a lot of it, too, is what people are just like lemmings. They're just gullible and they're just taking what, you know, some higher power in society, whether it's the media or whatever it is, politicians are prescribing. You know, here, you're supposed to feel offended when this is said, right. So be offended. And people jump on that for some reason. It's almost not authentic.
Yeah, I'm going to just simply give my personal opinion here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the fact that someone so ill-equipped, so ill-tempered, so intellectually inferior as a Donald Trump and many of the Republican people that profess what they do today, the fact that they are in office means each time they win an election, that means because somebody, more people voted for them than voted for the other side. I think that that is a damning analysis of our educational system in this country and what it has been allowed to become. You know, There is the adage, there is the saying that a population gets the government that it deserves.
Mm.
And so many of those, and you know, I don't like to be an ideologue, but in the observation of half of our leadership in government now perpetrating the myth, the lie, the BS that Donald Trump won the last election, and you've got a large percentage of people buying into that bullshit, it is a damning indictment of our educational system, where folks are not taught to think for themselves, to have independent thought and analysis. And so, you know, that's one of the places where I would start to talk about how do we dramatically improve our educational system. K through 12 and well beyond into college, man. I mean, because in my way of thinking, I can't find a legitimate argument for that, because you know, our educational system is supposed to teach and to yield smart people. And, you know, for smart people to support somebody like Kosar, who just did the video of him killing AOC, or that nut from Texas, Gomer, what's his name?
Gomer. He's the dumbest man in Congress.
Gomer, man. I mean, you know, it's really crazy. And I think textbook 101 indictment of our educational system.
And Congress has become mean, right? It's never been Mark Twain. I think Mark Twain gave the best analysis of Congress. He used to call it the home for the criminally inept. But, you know, they've gone from that to being mean as well. I've got to ask you this question. I was raised a Catholic, and I know that Marilla was too. I'm pretty sure she was. Yep. And on behalf of my mother, and I assume Marilla's too, I have to ask you, what was it like to meet the Pope?
That's a really good question that I wanted to know.
Yeah. What was that like? That's all I'd have to do, Rock. If I met the Pope, I wouldn't have to do anything else in my life to make my grandmother happy. I would have been her favorite.
Let me tell you, I had a vision for quite some time. When I was working with Michael Spinks and Butch Lewis, for the image of boxing and for the image of boxers, I thought that an opportunity to interact with the Pope, to get photographs, you know, taken with him, you know, the heavyweight champion, you know, sort of as the baddest man on the planet. The Pope is a symbol. Of, you know, peace and righteousness. Now we can debate that, but because the Catholic Church has had a lot of problems. I too grew up Catholic. I was an altar boy, and one of the things that I said to the Pope when I met him was that I had been an altar boy. I was no longer then or now a practicing Catholic, you know. You saw sort of the magnitude, you know, we were there at the Vatican, you know, when he was conducting mass. And I'll tell you, as big as that moment was, what really I was feeling was that I had a pair of rosary and I was going to ask him to bless the rosary for my mother. My mother is a lifelong Catholic. You know, there have been times when multiple times a week, you know, she would go to church. And so I wanted to present her with those rosary beads that were blessed by the Pope. And I can tell you, she's been proud of things that I have done, but I can tell you the picture that I took with the Pope, those rosary beads, they were front and center in the living room in the little house that we grew up in. Once I gave her those things, man, I think that finally I had arrived. You know, I'd done a few other things, but meeting the Pope in her eyes was one of the great things that she was just unbelievably proud of. And I'll tell you a quick little funny story. So the Pope was doing, you know, he's doing the mass, and he did a part of the homily. He did it in 13 different languages. And if you close your eyes, you would have thought there was a Japanese person speaking. You would have thought it was an African speaking Swahili. You would have thought it was a Frenchman speaking. And so he did it in 13 different languages. And we had a couple of young guys with us, One is a local there in the D.C. area now. Got to give them a plug. Bernard Brooks, the owner of Henry's Soul Food Cafe. Well, Bernie was probably, I don't know, maybe 22 at the time, and he and his friend, you know, they were ladies' men. And so at the end of the church service, when we were back in the limo, they said, man, the Pope just did that in 13 different languages. If the Pope wasn't a Pope, he'd sure be a serious international player. So that's what they took away. But you know, it was a great experience. It had come on the heels of meeting and spending 3 days with Nelson Mandela. And
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, that was life transforming for me. You know, I'd always heard about, you know, somebody walk in the room and the room fills up. And
oh, yeah.
I didn't get it. I frankly didn't get it. I never saw it. I never felt it. Man, we were sitting in, we were at Nelson Mandela's house, and he came into the living room where we were, and yes, the room, all the oxygen, it took up. It's just, he's someone that I think, you know, when you talk about being a saint, when you talk about being a statesman, he's all of those, he was all of those things and more. And one of the people that, you know, I certainly most admire in my life.
He is Archpope to me.
Well, and you know, it's good to find out, Rock, that the reason that I was never a player is because I'm monolingual. I always wondered why, you know.
You got to be like Pope, man.
Yeah, if I just studied more languages, you know, it would have gone better for me. But let me ask you something that's really important to me, and that is you bought back 3,000 guns. D.C. Murder rate is up 25%. You and Marilla and I, actually all three of us grew up in the Washington area, and we probably remember during the crack epidemic that we got up to 800 murders in a year. But, we're not nowhere near that today. But we still have kids killing each other over their tennis shoes. You know, I grew up in a bad neighborhood, Rock, in North New Jersey when I was a kid. But the kids didn't kill each other. What? Any explanation on what's going on today? Is it about respect? Is it, you know, is it about the pandemic? You know, why are kids shooting each other?
There is a continuing breakdown of American society now. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, back then there were 800. So it's not hardly like it just started now. But there is a breakdown. I remember giving a speech at the boys' facility over in Blue Plains, where you got kids in there, you know, jailed really, as young as 18 years old. And I think on that night that I gave that speech, they ran from like 18 to maybe 16 years old. And I pride myself on being able to connect with an audience, whatever audience it is I might be speaking to. And guys, what I felt that night did something to me that rarely ever happens. I rarely get depressed. I walked out of there that night absolutely depressed because I didn't see any hope. I didn't feel any hope. These were kids whose eyes were blank, man. I failed no matter how profound, funny, whatever it was I tried to be. I totally fail to connect to them. Where, you know, I'm used to, you know, having a conversation or presenting before a group of folks, and somewhere at the end, you know, people are feeling inspired and motivated. And it was abjectly absent there. Now, for those kids to be so hopeless, it doesn't take a great leap to feel, if you feel you don't have any hope, your behavior will be antisocial. Mm-hmm. Your behavior will be self-destructive because you ain't got nothing to live for.
Right.
And again, now, that to me, that's got to be attacked from every single level. You know, again, it's responsibility starts at home. But goddamn it, when you're having 14 and 15 year olds that are popping out babies, you know, it's going to be hard for them to teach responsibility because they don't know responsibility. And that's an issue that becomes a very much an issue of priorities of this government that ignores the devastating damage of poverty and not really an embrace of the things that could change and to help bring people out of poverty. So, you know, I mean, man, we could go on. We could really go on all night about that. But, you know, I know you got a lot of other stuff you want to talk about also.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I remember very distinctly studying the work Inferno by Dante. And Dante writes above the gates of hell, let all that enter here give up all hope. And, you know, I remember the professor saying the reason he did that is because he couldn't think of anything more horrible for the human condition than not to have hope. So, you know, he thought that was singly the most horrible thing you could say to somebody is there is no hope. So I think he hit the nail right on the head.
And I think what goes hand in hand with that, too, for these poor kids is lack of self-esteem, basically a lack of self-like.
Yeah.
They don't like themselves, and that's why they do also engage in this antisocial behavior. And it has huge origins that go back hundreds of years, and I think you and I know what those origins are.
Yeah, and, you know, And that's it. I grew up in a family that was dysfunctional in many ways, and we were poor. But my parents and the people around me liked me. I mean, it's absolutely the truth. And I've grown up and I've seen people who weren't liked and what that's done in their life. But I think you're absolutely right. They always taught me that no matter what the circumstances of my life were, I was a decent person and that I was worthy of being loved and respected. But of course, they never told me I should speak 14 languages. So, I hold that against my dad. But I think it's I just hate to see this because, like I say, in Newark was a bad city, but kids didn't kill each other. You know, there were many other problems. Well, Rock, we're almost running out of time here. Is there anything you want to say that we haven't asked you? Anything you want to mention now that we got
you? You know, man, I will tell you. You know, I'm pretty active on Facebook. You know, I had the TV show. I've stayed pretty active on Facebook, and it's something that I have a number of times. And we touched on, you know, tonight here, you know, sort of the denigration, how our educational system is so failing us. And I have a little bit of a crusade about, I think, in large part, next to the influence of a good mother, and I'm going to say good mother, a good father, that teachers are our most valuable human asset. And I believe that a teacher's salary, now I'm putting out a number that there's not any particular magic to it, but it's, I want people to think about it, that if teachers, good teachers, you got to pass certain tests and you got to prove yourself. Teachers should be paid a minimum of $100,000 a year.
Amen.
And folks instantly start talking about, oh, well, how are you going to pay for that and all that? And I'm going to say this. If you get a good teacher in a classroom of 22 kids or however many it might be, and that good teacher is bringing quality education to students, and these students are absorbing it, you're going to have students who are more productive, who are less violent, less likely to do antisocial things. And if you do that, that cuts down on what other resources that you might have to use, like police, like prosecutors, like the courts, and all of that. And you know what? It goes on and on and on. That if someone is coming in and saying, okay, I can compete with some of these other industries in terms of being able to take care of myself, you would get a higher quality of instructor who would make a difference in the classroom, in the school, in the community, in the region, and in the country. And, you know, so I want to get that in, because I just have such a strong passion about that.
Well, let me tell you something, Rock Newman. Mrs. Brown, who is the librarian at a high school, just became your number one fan. She would agree with you 100%. I can't tell you, Rock, how much we appreciate you being on the show. Marilia, is there anything you want to add?
I was just going to add one more thing to what you said, which I absolutely agree with, and that is you ask how are we going to pay these teachers? Well, having worked in government and politics, I'm here to say there is enough fraud, waste, and abuse in government to pay teacher salaries at the level you're talking about.
Yeah. Hallelujah, amen. Namaste.
Hallelujah, amen. Let's leave our discussion there. What a great place to end it. And let me tell you, we always end our show with a song. Generally, we dedicate this to our guests. And when it comes to Rock Newman, there were so many cool songs, you know, so many, you know, Rock of Ages, Let Us Rock You. Right? But I'm going with the classic, and I hope you like this one, Rock. It's from B.B. King. Here's Rock Me Baby, and we'll talk to you next week. And thank you, Rock Newman.
Thank you guys so much. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, Rock.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Wonderful.
All right. God bless you.
See you.
Thank you.
God bless you.